We left off last week talking about a man, Abram. But there is also somebody else that he bounced into along the way, a guy named Melchizedek. Now, we read of Melchizedek essentially in two other places. We read his name a couple of different times, but essentially two other places. Anyone? Anyone?
Hebrews.
Yes. Hebrews. And the other one? Psalm 110, which is what the Hebrew author quotes from. Okay. So turn to Hebrews. And this is the question. Do you know how the author of Hebrews uses Melchizedek in his argument in the book of Hebrews? Okay? He does use them three different ways. Two at least, and I like to throw a third way in there. So, George had his head vehemently nodding yes, so please provide us with your answer.
Basically, the idea is that if Jesus is a priest, like Melchizedek was a priest, so according to the order of Melchizedek, then the law must have changed for Jesus to be a legitimate priest, because under the law of Moses, a priest could only come from the tribe of Levi, and Jesus did not.
Okay. There were three ways that it's used. He mentioned the last way that it's referred to in the book of Hebrews. George is in Hebrews chapter 7. Verse 14, it is evident that our Lord was descended from a Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. And it is still clear, if another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become not such on the basis of law, of the physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life, for it is attested of him, and he quotes from Psalm 110, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And he had said right before that, if it's according to Melchizedek, then it's not according to Leviticus, which means it's a different law. That's George's point. Back up in the same chapter, verse 7, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the God Most High, met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. By the way, when you're reading through Genesis, chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, and you say Abram, or you say Abraham, like I always do, you're in good company because he called him Abraham here when he was still actually Abram. Okay, but that was just a side note. To whom also Abram apportioned a tenth of all the spoils. So this is referring back to the account in Genesis 14. Abram comes back, and there's Melchizedek. And Abram gives Melchizedek a tenth of what he has. Now, what does he say? The author of Hebrews writes in chapter 7, verse 7, without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. And so, to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Okay, Levi wasn't born yet. But the argument is, look, if Abraham is paying tithes to Melchizedek, then what's that say about Levi? Levi, if he had been there, he would have been paying tithes to Melchizedek. And who's the greater? Melchizedek is of the two. So this is a different way that he's using the same character, Melchizedek. He's saying, look, the Levitical priesthood isn't the greatest thing ever. We have proof of that. Look at Melchizedek. And that's one argument, and then he'll make the application, and not even Melchizedek is the greatest one, but Jesus Christ is the greatest one. All right. There's a third way he also uses Melchizedek in Hebrews chapter 5, where he introduces Melchizedek. Basically, one of the counter-arguments that the Hebrew would make is, well, Jesus called himself a high priest, and that doesn't count. And the Hebrew writer will say, no, Jesus didn't call himself a high priest. For no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he was called by God, even as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you, Psalm 2. And he also says in another passage, Psalm 110, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So basically, The writer of Hebrews uses that in three different ways. If you got the one that George mentioned, that's good. Remember that. But back here in Genesis chapter 14, I find it interesting, while you're turning back there, that, let me ask this question. Is the conclusion that the law of Moses is no longer binding, is that a significant conclusion? Does that have any weight to it? Yes. Wow. The argument that he makes, now the inspired writers use many different arguments, but this one argument is based on this one guy, Melchizedek. And how much do we know about this one guy, Melchizedek? We know just that not much. We know essentially nothing about him. The point is this. God can use an obscure passage to make a point that is so resounding that it'll totally change everybody's life. If that's the only argument he had, that would have been good enough. Of course, he has more. So, if somebody ever says to you, oh, don't you worry about some obscure passage in Romans or something like that, there is no such thing as an obscure passage with the Lord. If he says it once, that's all he needs to say. Any thoughts about Melchizedek? I remember when I had first become a Christian, of course I grew up going to church and staring out the window, but at least I was assimilating some of it. And when I became a Christian, I was about 24, and I got myself these three expensive leather-bound Bibles with all the information in it. And I said to my dad one day while we were on the job doing construction, I said, I'm going to figure out who Melchizedek is. That didn't last very long. Okay. Genesis 15 through 18, questions and answers. Jacob, please. Chapter 15, list all the Lord had told Abram. Skim it.
Not to be afraid, his own son will be his heir, and he will have countless offspring.
Yeah, good. How did Abram respond to the Lord's promise, Jonathan?
He believed him.
Yes. What more did God promise Abram, Gary?
Your descendants shall inherit this land.
How did Abram respond, Gary?
How shall I know?
And Gary, how did God respond?
God made a covenant with Abram, and that his descendants, basically God says, they will.
Yes. That's right. Okay. We're going to skip the next one for now. Chapter 16, what did Sarai recognize? And George Bosworth, please. Yes, and I was looking for God had prevented it. God's providential working in her life. That's what I was looking for. But you're right. She did recognize that she had had no children. What did she and Abram do? Jim, please.
Abram allowed Sarai to treat the maid harshly.
Okay, and before that, they proposed this alternative of providing Hagar to produce a child. What did Hagar do then, George?
She fled into the wilderness.
Yeah. First she despised Sarai, and then Sarai mistreated her, and then she took off into the wilderness. What did the Lord tell Hagar? Several answers. Florence, please.
Return to Sarai, and he told her, her descendants will multiply greatly.
Right.
That she is the child.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit more about Ishmael himself. How old was Abram? John, more, please. Let's go back up here. John Bosworth.
86.
Yes. And how old was Abram? John Bosworth, please.
99.
Yes, very good. And what were the conditions of the covenant? We'll pass on that one for now. What was the sign of the covenant? George.
His name was changed in the circumcision.
Yes. And what did the Lord say of Sarah? Jonathan, please.
It would be her child that the promise would kill him.
What? I wasn't listening. Say it again, please. Was it right? I'm sure it was.
Yeah, it would be her child that would fulfill the child.
Oh, okay. Excellent. And how did Abram respond? Okay, let's see back here. George Tweedy, please. Oh, dear. Someone? Anyone? Gary. He laughed. And also suggested Ishmael. Okay, I asked this question, take a stab at it. It's not in the text itself, but what do these events of the two chapters emphasize about Abraham? He's what? He can be a critic. Yes, he believed God. Anybody else have anything else in here?
A son was important to him.
A son was important to him. Excellent. Yes. Ah, well, she didn't cheat. I have, well, maybe she did. She just changed it enough. I wrote that his humanness. Her word is better. Okay, that's whatever. Those are things that all are good. What would happen to Ishmael, Marcy? Yeah, and what would the Lord do with Isaac, Marcy? Again. All right, and when would the child of promise be born? Jim Sullivan, please.
At the same time next year.
Yeah, we're going to skip the last parts of that for now. All right, here we are in Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord. You'll note that that is the first time this expression is used in Scripture, which I find interesting. The word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, I am a shield to you, your reward will be very great." Okay, I suppose that chapter 14 and chapter 15 are closely connected, because what had just happened? Abram had just gone tearing off, beat up on four kings at nighttime, and then came tearing back. He was successful in it. On his way back, he said to the king of Sodom, "No thanks, I don't want your reward." Chapter 15, God comes up to him and says, "Don't fear, Abram. I'll be a shield to you." I think that he may be somewhat concerned about having riled up the anger of the four kings that, hey, they've come this far once, they might come again. I don't know exactly what it is. But the Lord is going to be an invisible force field around Abram, making him undefeatable. Okay? "Your reward shall be very great." I think what's happening here is back in chapter 14, Abram said, "No thanks, Sodom." And then he refers to God Most High. "I have sworn by God Most High that I will not take anything from you, lest you be able to say that you've made me great." Abram here in chapter 14 is putting his trust in God. And I think God sees that in chapter 15 and says, "Hey, here's a man that's willing to totally wait on me, and I'm going to bless him more now than he ever could have imagined. And this is part of it. Your reward will be very great." Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus." By the way, there are Nuzi tablets that demonstrate that a childless man could adopt one of his own male servants to be the heir and guardian of his estate. This is sounds weird to us. Well, he's not the son. It would go to the state or something like that for us, or a cousin. But they would take a servant that was as close as a son, almost, you get the picture of it here, and say, "Here, he's going to be my heir." Abram said, "Since you have given me no offspring, one born in my house is my heir." Now, Abram says to God, "You have given me no offspring." I don't know if he says, "You haven't given me any offspring," or, "You haven't given me any offspring." I don't know. Is it doubt? Or is it only curiosity? Or is there some mix in there? I'm not there. But, verse 4, "Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This man will not be your heir, but one will come forth from your own body, a biological son.'" Abram, you're going to have somebody that's biologically yours, DNA compatible. "He shall be your heir." And he took him outside and said, I don't often do this, but I can imagine God putting his arm around Abram's shoulder and saying, "Take a look up in the sky." Because you can't, even if you could count the stars, your descendants are going to be more than that up there. Okay, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. We'll have some more to say about that. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans. And here's promise number two, to give you this land to possess. Now, Abram says to him, O Lord, how may I know that I may possess it? This is at least the third time he's heard this. And it's almost been, in chapter 16, it'll be 10 years since he's been hearing this. So you get the idea that Abram's saying, okay, I've heard it once, twice, if you, depending on how you're counting, three times, and now this is a fourth. It's at least the third time, and he's saying, Lord, give me something more here. So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other. He did not cut the birds. Skip down to verse 17. It came about then when the sun had set, it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. The smoking oven and the flaming torch. Take away for a moment the oven and the torch, and you have what? Smoke and flame. And what does the Lord, when the Lord came to Mount Sinai, what happened? Fire came down on the mountain, and the smoke went up like a furnace. Over and over you read in the Old Testament, when God manifested himself, how did God manifest himself to Moses? Fire. What's the Shekinah glory? Anybody know what I'm talking about when I use that word? No, you'll know what I'm talking about now. When they finally consecrate the altar and the temple, the tabernacle, God comes down and lights everything up with fire, okay? When the temple is consecrated, well, it may not happen there, sorry. I might be going a bit too far there. But we see God manifesting himself to people in fire often, and where there's fire, there's smoke. You know the expression. Okay. So, the second part of this. Basically, the smoking oven, the flaming torch represent the Lord, somehow represent the Lord, and they pass between these two pieces. Verse 18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. This sounds very weird to us. Give me some animals, cut them in half, and I'm going to walk in between them. All right. And, by the way, I'm going to call that a covenant. All right. Jeremiah refers to this very process. God says, those people who made a covenant with me and have been going back on their word, but he uses the word covenant and then says they walked between the cut pieces. Sounds weird, but it's what they did. Some have suggested that the idea is this. You see these animals on the ground here that are cut in half? If I don't stay by my word, may it be done to me just like these animals. That's not unreasonable. I don't know if it's the most reasonable, but it makes some sense. Anyways, there's a covenant here. He makes a covenant, and as Gary said earlier, God is saying, believe me. You can trust me. Remember, Abram started out by saying, Lord, how may I know I possess the land? And God essentially answers, don't worry, Abram, you can trust me, whatever I say here. All right. There's
Chapter 15 starts off with the word of the Lord coming to Abram in a vision.
Yeah.
Is it clear to you whether or not this whole chapter is part of this vision, or when the vision stops and reality takes over?
No.
Okay, good.
And, you're not the only one?
Yeah.
Right. No, I don't. I can't tell you. That's all I'll say. Okay, we got more to cover here, but some things to think about, first of all. Trust God. If Abram had reason to trust God, we have 4,000 more years of evidence than Abram had. Remember, it said that he believed in the Lord, and he was reckoned to him as righteousness. Abram says, okay, you said it, God, I'll believe it. And that should be our approach. Throw yourselves under God's shield. God said, don't worry, Abram, I am a shield to you. Do you remember Romans 8? What's Romans 8 say? It's the passage that says, I am convinced that neither a whole bunch of things can separate us from the love of God. It also is the passage that says that God works good for all those who love him. in the middle of all that, it says, if God is for us, who could be against us? God, the same thing God said to Abram in a vision directly, he says to us in Romans chapter 8, don't worry, God is our shield. At the same time, Ephesians 6, remember the end of Ephesians 6 when we're fighting this spiritual warfare? Ephesians 6, be strong in the Lord. Verse 11, put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. Look in verse 16. In addition to all, taking up the shield of faith with which you will be able to extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. So what we get here is the same thing in Romans 8, except it's more put on to us. Yes, Romans 8, God will protect us if Ephesians 6, we're putting on the shield of faith. It depends on what we're doing also. If you have something to add, let me know. Something about the land here. The map of the land, or the land. Verse 18. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. And you get all this land. Okay. What's that? The great river. Otherwise known as? What's that? The brook or the river of Egypt. Not the Nile. There's a river Egypt right there. And then there's the Nile. And he's saying from the river Egypt, so you'll get that land, is what he's saying. Let me ask you, this is a quiz. I asked the same thing I think last week. Okay, so here's a promise. Here's the land. Did God ever fulfill his promise to the Israelites? Yes. Show me. Okay. Okay, actually, Solomon.
Well, David conquered
all. Okay, he didn't actually get up to the river Euphrates. Solomon is the one that got all the way to river Euphrates. There's a little, David had a little bit less land than Solomon did. But you're right, later on. They did get the land later on, okay? I need my pointer thingy, I don't know where it is. Oh, here it is. Okay. You see that little river right there? That's this right here, right? See, it hooks down. It hooks down. This is Solomon's land. Even all down there touching the Red Sea. Barely touching it. And then up here, you see this hook in the Euphrates? Area is, Solomon has this land up here. David's came to in this area. And it might even be that. I don't know exactly which. But Solomon here has all this land. Okay. The point being this. Did God ever fulfill his promises that he made to the Israelites? Yes. The land promise. The inspired book of Joshua says, Joshua 21, he gave us all the good promises he made, he fulfilled them. So, the next time you're wondering, talking with somebody who's waiting for this to happen in the future, you can point them out, Joshua 21, and say, I'm sorry, I believe Joshua 21. If you don't have any other response than, I'm sorry, I believe Joshua 21, then you're fine. The inspired word. Yes?
Isn't this Ishmael coming later and all that? Ishmael? The whole Jew-Muslim thing over this exact land, didn't that get started with Hagar's son?
Yes.
Okay, so
we have her to thank for this.
Yeah, that's a long way back.
And when I say her, I'm not talking about Hagar. I'm talking about Sarah. Yeah. Yeah, it goes a long way back.
I mean, it's just amazing because that's the land still.
Yep.
Still.
Well, I mean, what does it say about Israel?
Yeah.
Yep. And he died fighting his family. Yeah. Isn't that a way to go? That's my epitaph. Is that right? Yeah. He died fighting his family. Okay. All right, a couple other things here. Oh, I kind of skipped one. They go hand in hand with this. I meant to say the other one first. It doesn't really matter. It says, what does he say? He comes out and count the stars, and so your descendants shall be. When you count those stars... Now, this is obviously figurative language, right? But it has a fulfillment. When was this fulfilled? You don't have to turn there.
They were actually in Egypt.
Okay.
They weren't organized as a nation yet, but they were a great multitude of people.
Right. And growing and growing and growing. And then they continued to grow. Go ahead. Right. And when was this fulfilled? Dual fulfillment, right? Now, this doesn't actually have dual fulfillment, if you will, but the land, when was the land fulfilled? Joshua 21 and up till David Solomon's time, okay, the land was fulfilled. But it is a picture. How many times do you read the word inheritance in the New Testament? Frequently. I think you'll read it in the New American Standard 26 times, and about 20 of them are referring to Christians. Your inheritance. Acts 20 and other places. Your inheritance that you'll have, your imperishable, eternal inheritance. So it's a type of what the Christians expect in the future, the promised land, the kingdom of heaven, and being with God himself. He talks about being... We skip this, so we'll go back and read it. Chapter 15... Verse 12, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, terror in great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your father in peace, you will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Okay, when is this written?
Well, Moses wrote it after they were coming out.
After they're coming out and before they're going into the land. Okay, so they're wondering, hey, why do we get this land anyway? Here's the answer. But even before that, if they're wondering, was that little stint there in Egypt where we all were being tortured and almost died, was that an accident? No. They're reaffirmed here. No, God knew what was happening. God was in control the whole time. Also, if the Jew were to knock on the door of the Canaanite and say, get out, because this is my land, and the reason I'm getting it is because I'm so much better than you are, what would the answer be? No. Also written at the same time, within 40 years, of Genesis chapter 15, where he says, the Amorite of the iniquity is not yet complete. They're sinners. And when their sin has been piled up, remember Deuteronomy? Where is it? Deuteronomy 9? Deuteronomy 9, verse 4, do not say in your heart, when the Lord your God has driven them out before you, because of my righteousness the Lord brought me in to possess this land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is dispossessing them. It is not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart that you are going to possess the land, but it is because of the wickedness of these nations. If he hadn't said it enough, he's got to say it again. So, it will be humbling for the Jews. It's also new information to Abram. He hasn't quite heard yet that his family is going to suffer, has he? And they'd endure the pain to receive the promise. It would get worse before it got better. Note well, God's people's physical comfort here on earth is not his main concern. Otherwise, he would have protected them. Yeah, he put them in Goshen, and so when it's in accordance with his plan, he'll do it. But that's not his main concern. All right. Let's talk about this now briefly. Who thinks the 400 years began when?
Well, there's two trains of thought.
Uh-huh.
Either it started here or it started when Jacob went down.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll just tell you what I think.
You
I think there are two thoughts. I do think it's here, but it's not by, it's not. Okay, first of all, is it from the initial entry into Egypt? Because if you turn to Exodus 12, it sure seems that way. In fact, if all you had was Exodus 12, you'd say, duh, why would you even think something else? Exodus 12, and maybe some still think that. Exodus 12, verse 40. The time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. That does sound like it starts from what I say, Genesis 46, when they go into Egypt, really. Right.
The Lord says, hey, what's up? God says, go. I take it from that day.
Right.
That's what I'm speaking of.
Yeah. Yeah, and if it weren't for Galatians 3, I would probably think exactly the same thing unhesitantly. But there's Galatians 3. Turn to Galatians 3. Paul is arguing about faith. More about that in a minute. Oops. Galatians 3, verse 16. The promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say seeds as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. What I am saying is this: the law, which came 430 years later, okay, if the stay in Exodus in Egypt was 430 years, then you'd have to add another 215 years to this, to that, and the law actually would have been 645 years later. But Paul says that the law came after the promises 430 years. All right. Does that make sense? Okay, you might be having an issue with why does he say 215 years later? We'll talk about that. First of all, the genealogies... Oh, okay, hold on. Oh, Acts 13, you can turn there and read it on your own, allows for this. Acts 7 is ambiguous. It doesn't help us either way. Acts 13 helps for this. The Septuagint in Exodus 12, 40, the Septuagint, which was written when? 250 years before any of this stuff was written that we're reading now, says that their stay in Exodus 12, where it says 430 years was in Egypt, in our text, in the Septuagint says, in Egypt and in Canaan. And all of the Samaritan Pentateuchs say in Egypt and in Canaan in Exodus 12, 40. Is that significant? It's weighty, but it's not, you know, it's not inspired, as it were. Also, the genealogies allow for it. I'll just say this. We'll look at one of them. Genesis 15, 16 says that they'll return in the fourth generation. Take a guess at how many generations it was from Levi to Aaron and Moses. Four. Okay? And the same, Caleb was the fourth from Judah. Four generations, okay? So the genealogies fit. Now, at the same time, the math allows for it. Abram's entry into Canaan to the birth of Isaac was 25 years. When Abram entered the land, till Isaac was born, is 25 years. Isaac was 60 when Jacob was born, and Jacob was 130 when he entered the land. You add all that up, it's 215 years. Now, go back up here. If it's 430 years from the initial promise, that leaves 215 years in Egypt. If there are four generations, literally, in Egypt, that would be one person being born every 53 years. That is not unreasonable. How old was Moses when he got married? 40. And then he had children. So, the short of it is this. It does work. And Galatians 3 seems to hint towards that. Yep.
Just a question.
Yep. I don't know the answer.
You said a genealogy is allowed for from Genesis 15 or from Jacob's entry?
Jacob's entry. Well, they allow for That's a difficult.
Now you're four generations where Levi's born.
Sorry, what?
I'm not following your.
The fourth generation thing?
Yeah.
Okay, verse 16, it says, in the fourth generation they will return here.
I understand that, but these men who you're coming from are not born yet. You have Isaac.
No, right, I understand. In the fourth generation after they've been in the land,
right,
is the way you would interpret it this way.
Right. Right. So I didn't know if you were using.
No.
Which way you were using the generation.
Right,
the genealogy.
Right. So, there you go. When you figure out the answer, let me know. Anybody else have a comment or a question?
I have a question.
Oh, dear.
Either way you look at it, you're suggesting that they weren't oppressed for 400 years. They're only suppressed for 215 in fact, right?
Well, they weren't oppressed for 430 years,
okay.
No matter how you look at it. Okay. It was only later. No matter how you look at it, it was only later in their stay, or at least not in the beginning of their stay in Egypt.
They first went down, they were
high on living the big life.
Because I always assumed it was there, but I never looked at dates. When it says a new pharaoh arose that didn't know God's people,
right.
I had never done what you did, and I'm obviously wrong, but I always assumed the 400 years started there. Because it says in Genesis 15 that they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
The only, yes. And it does allow for some flexibility in the language of being enslaved and oppressed for 400 years, when in fact they're not really enslaved and oppressed for 400 years in Egypt anyway. So there is flexibility in the language built in, no matter which interpretation you have. He wants to say something.
Next time you do something like this, I suppose you can do a slide with like two timelines that chopped up the different ways.
Yes. I'll let you do it and send it to me, if you will. Oh, wait, John wants to say something.
I was just going to say that to be enslaved, I mean, you can be enslaved by your circumstances, having to live in a place where you really don't want to live also.
Mm-hmm. Or you can be enslaved in not having what is rightfully yours. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, it's flexible. All right, shall we? Anybody else? Anything else? All right, we have to talk about this really quickly. Verse 6, he believed in the Lord and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. This is quoted four times in the New Testament. Anyone? Anyone? Romans is two of them. Two in Romans. You remember what he's saying?
Yeah, it's the argument to the Jew.
Right.
You know, look, Abram believed God, and he acted on his belief.
Yeah.
I'm not doing a very good job.
No, that's... I put you on the spot. Romans 4... By the way, you've just summarized the entire book of Romans. If you can remember that, then you've got the book of Romans down. verse 2, if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. What does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, it was credited to him as righteousness. Not to the one who works, his wage is not credited as favor, but what is due. But the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited to him as righteousness. So, he's saying here that it's not according to works. Even, it doesn't matter what the works are, works of the law of Moses or works of some other works, it doesn't matter what the works are, you cannot work your way into heaven. You cannot do it. But he is especially applying it to the law of Moses. The law of Moses works. You can do them all day long too, because that's what they think. Oh wait, we have the law. We can do that. But he says no. Verse 20, because by works of the law of Moses, which it had just quoted from the law of Moses, no flesh will be justified. So, not works, not just works will do, and especially works of the law of Moses. Faith is necessary. That's what he's saying. You Jews, you have to believe. Nicodemus, you can't just walk into the kingdom. John 3:16, you have to believe in the Son, right? Galatians 3, same point he makes to the same audience, not Rome, but the same people dealing with the same problem. And then there's another one, which is James. Yeah? Well, you were close. You would have got there. James. But what's James arguing in the book of James?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Verse 14. What use is it, my brethren, if someone has faith and he has no works? Can that faith save him? The answer is no. Verse 17. Faith, if it has no works, is dead. And then you can read the context. Verse 21. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works? Well, wait a minute. What's going on here? When he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar, you see that faith was working with his works, and as real the works of the works, the faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. So I find this interesting. By the way, to what passage did James refer? James quoted something, and he referred to something else. Which is Genesis 22. So he refers to Genesis 22, but he quotes from Genesis 15. Genesis 15. And so we have something going on here that we understand. A couple things. First of all, works are necessary. There's nowhere in the Bible does it say that works are not necessary. And he applies to Genesis 22, Genesis 15, and his point is that ongoing faithful obedience leads to being reckoned righteous. It's not that he was just righteous once and faithful once and that's it, that's all he had to do. But he continued, Abram continued to obey God, and every time he obeyed God, James says, it is fulfilled again, it is fulfilled again, it is fulfilled again. Neither works or faith are sufficient. Neither of them is sufficient. Both are necessary. You can have all the faith in the world you want, but will that faith save you? No. You have to have works also. Paul says you can have all the works in the world you want, but will those works save you? No. You have to have faith. He put the two together. Different situations call for different responses, reactions. I hope I make myself clear on this. Some require more than nothing more than mental assent. When God said, you're going to have a lot of children, did that require immediately anything of Abram? He had to say, okay, that's it. But some situations require more than just mental assent, saying, okay. Some require that you have to automatically put something into action. Am I making sense? No. Some people are...
You are.
Okay.
Your descendants are going to be as multitudes of heaven, and his wife is barren. It's like, oh, he's got to have a barrier where he has no children.
Okay. Excellent point. Romans, turn to Romans.
ASSENT.
Sorry, did I misspell it?
I'm totally confused, because yes, and I was thinking...
Where am I?
Going up a cent.
Oh, yes. No, that's wrong.
Okay. And I...
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, this is the second time Paul quotes it in Romans 4, verse 19. Without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 400 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. Yet, with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully assured of what God had promised, he was able also to perform. Therefore, it was also credited to him as righteousness. So, as Gary was hinting at, I'm making a tiny bit more explicit, did the promise God made, you're going to have descendants that are like the sky. Did it require any action on Abram's part? Well, duh. And here Paul much admits it. So even in the context of what some would turn to this passage and say, faith only, look at Abraham. No, Abraham also had to do works. Paul says it, and so does James. Hope that's relatively clear. I know it's a lot.
The way these evangelicals interpret that passage is they say that
we're justified by faith, but the work it's talking about is justification before men.
Well, the only thing is that the Bible doesn't say that.
I know.
Right? Yeah, I know, right. So
and
if they say
it. Interestingly, when he took his son to sacrifice, I don't see any record of an audience of people.
Yep. Yep. Excellent. Okay. We have talked about a whole bunch there, a mouthful. Anybody want to add something before we go on in Genesis 16? All right. Genesis 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. By the way, it's almost 10 years now. That's another 10 long years. And she's waiting. The promise seems harder, and it don't get any easier for an old lady to have children. She had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. We know the rest of the story. Three things about this. First of all, the power of a woman. We have read two accounts of two women so far, and what have they both done? Influenced their husband the wrong way. The point, ladies, is this. The power that you have. You know, first of all, be careful. Don't influence the husband the wrong way. And Peter, when Peter says that you can win your husband without a word, it assumes this power that you have on your husband. Number two, the power of a man. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, this is a temptation for Abram, apparently. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says what? God won't put you in a position where he could have told Sarah, his wife, no. And by the way, we know of another woman who said to her husband, "Curse God." And what did that husband say? "You foolish woman." So it is, we have the power, husbands. And then the third point is the prerogative of God. He wants us to marry somebody who's not going to suggest idiot things like this, but instead suggest godly, let's wait on the Lord, would have been the way to go there. Remember this. Okay, so in Hagar, verse 3, Abram had lived 10 years in the land. Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar, and the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to husband as his wife. This is the only time that Hagar is called his wife. It is his wife. She is his wife, but secondary, obviously. He went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. The pronouns are difficult there, but Hagar thinks she's better than Sarah or Sarai. Sarai said, "May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me." This is not exactly the most logical thing I've heard this woman say so far. Abram, what are you going to do about this now? Okay, we'll stop there, or continue, actually, before I put my foot in my mouth. Verse 6, "Then Abram said to Sarai, 'Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight.' So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence." Stop here. This is the chain reaction fruit of trying to take matters into your own hands. Number one, she had doubt. God has prevented me. And then what did she do? She came up with a substitution. I'm going to do it myself. Here's my grand idea. Which led her to blaming her husband later on. And then it led her to be treated harshly by her maid. Which led her to treat her maid harshly. If we would just stop trying to take things into our own hands and let the Lord provide in His time how much we could save from ourselves. Now, having said all that about this woman, who is no stellar example so far, what is said of her in the New Testament? Hebrews 11, she's in the Hall of Faith, we call it sometimes. 1 Peter, looking up, Peter instructs all the women to look to Sarah. So if there's hope for her, then there's hope for me. Because I'm sure I've done worse than what I've read so far here of her. Well, the end of the little quote-unquote cat fight is that Sarai treated her harshly and she fled from her presence. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur, and he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Could you imagine Sarai seeing her walk back into the camp? The only way she could get back in is when Hagar says, I have a message from God. God has told me to come back. And there's nothing Sarai can do about that. She has to say, okay. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that there will be too many to count. The angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child. You will bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, which means, by the way, God sees. Because the Lord has given heed to your affliction, he will be a wild donkey of a man, and his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers. Genesis 25 says that he died fighting his relatives. We'll go on from there for a moment. Then she called the name of the Lord, who spoke to her, you are a God who sees, for she said, have I even remained alive after seeing him? Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahoi Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So, Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. I know this. I don't have much to say about this. Maybe you do. But when she's out there, her life is getting worse and worse and worse, Hagar's is. First of all, she was a servant, which isn't the greatest of positions, and then she became second best wife, mistreated by the husband and wife, and then kicked out by the whole family into the desert. Worse and worse and worse, but God comes along, and you know what he says to her? I know everything that you're going through. Don't worry. It's going to be okay. But go back. And this is going to help her. Okay, God knows. If she has any kind of faith, which it seems she has a little bit of kind of faith, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but that's all the faith you need. Okay, yeah, my life is horrible, but God knows what's happening, and he's going to make sure that everything works out in the end. I'll just do what he says. By the way, this is an illustration of, in the book of Ephesians, and all over the Old New Testament, servants are supposed to rebel against their unruly masters. Submit to your unruly masters, knowing what? They have a master in heaven watching over them. By the way, I always think of guys. Always naturally think of a guy and a servant guy. That's not necessarily the case. The woman can be, in this case, the master also. Anyways, we have an illustration of that passage there. Question or comment so far? We'll stop. Thank you for what you've said.
All right, before George leaves our closing prayer, our song.